You remember I challenged Dr. Avalos to discharge his share of the burden of proof tonight, to show us that either the resurrection narratives are false or give us some better explanation of them. He hasn't done that in tonight's debate. At best, he's tried to neutralize the ground, to show there's no historical evidence for the resurrection, but that doesn't show that, therefore, this is a fiction. So he still has yet to bear his burden of proof in tonight's debate. Now, have I been able to succeed in bearing my share of the burden? Well, I argued first that there are four facts that have been established about Jesus of Nazareth. And he dropped his point about textual purity in the last work. We saw that the text of the New Testament is 99% established, and that indeed denying the text of the New Testament would undermine his own work in ancient healthcare systems. But now he says, what about this problem with Matthew 27? Do you believe it's historical or not? Well, I'll repeat, I'm not sure. It depends on whether or not this is meant to be apocalyptic imagery by Matthew or a real, actual event. And I'm open-minded about this. Now, he says, but it is the same verb, a gerein, that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 15 to describe the resurrection. And it uses the word soma, body, the same word that you use or describe in 1 Corinthians 15 for Christ's resurrection. Well, obviously, but the point is not that Egerein and Soma show the historicity of these events. Rather, it means that what is being described is a physical resurrection. And that is the only kind of resurrection that Judaism knew. This has been demonstrated anew by N.T. Wright in his massive study, The Resurrection of the Son of God, released last summer. This is what Wright says. Let us be quite clear at this point. We shall see that when the early Christians said resurrection, they meant it in the sense that it bore both in paganism, which denied it, and Judaism, which affirmed it. Resurrection meant bodily resurrection, and that is what the early Christians affirmed. So these verbs go to show that when a person speaks of resurrection, you're talking about something that happens to the body. You're not talking about the immortality of the soul or something of that sort. But that doesn't decide the issue of whether or not the language being used here is apocalyptic and symbolic or not. Now, he says, well, what does it mean to say that something is apocalyptic? It just means it's more supernatural. No, no, not at all. Apocalyptic language will use figurative speech that isn't meant to be taken literally, like the sun turning dark and the moon turning to blood, or in the book of Revelation, dragons crawling up out of the oceans and so forth. When I was a young Christian, I used to think that the book of Revelation meant that actual seven-headed beasts would crawl out of the seas someday and destroy the earth. What I came to understand is that in apocalyptic literature, these are symbols or figures of speech for example, nation-states in the book of Revelation. And I'm frankly not sure whether Matthew means us to understand his resurrection of the saints as literal historical information or as symbolic or figurative. But what's quite clear, as I said, is that in the Markan account of the empty tomb, there is no apocalyptic language. When I say that this is simple and shows no signs of legendary embellishment, I mean that there is an utter absence of theological and apologetical motifs that characterize later legendary accounts, like Jesus being the king, Jesus raising the people in the intermediate state from the dead along with him, with his triumph over the enemies and so forth. It's a stark and simple historical account. It's not cast in apocalyptic imagery. So I think Dr. Avalos is simply quite wrong in saying that the case stands or falls on this single passage in Matthew. Nothing in my case depends upon how you treat that, either historically or apocalyptically as an image. Now he says, but what about this point about the first day of the week? This is an argument I give in my book that I didn't use tonight to show the earliness of the Markan account. The Markan account uses a phrase in Greek, the first day of the week, temia ton sabbaton, which is awkward in Greek. But when you translate it back into Aramaic, it is perfectly smooth and legitimate Aramaic or Hebrew. Temia ton sabbaton, when translated into Aramaic, is b'chath b'shabbatha. And this, he asked for the text where this is can be found. In the second Targum of Esther, chapter 2, verse 9, the same phrase is used. You can also find it in Hebrew as b'achad b'shabbat. And this is awkward in Greek because mia is a cardinal rather than an ordinal number. It means the one rather than the first. And sabbaton is the word for the Sabbath, not the word for the week. And yet it's used here to be the first day of the week. But in Aramaic or Hebrew, this is perfectly good Aramaic or Hebrew to say b'chach b'shabbatha. So I think this simply supports my point and shows the primitiveness of the Markan tradition, that we're in contact here with the original language spoken by the disciples. Well, he hasn't responded to the facts concerning Jesus' burial, the discovery of his empty tomb. With respect to the appearances, he says, but the appearance to James in Paul's list doesn't say that or isn't based upon James's dying for his faith, but the very passage he read from Josephus, where it refers to James, does say that during a lapse in the civil government, the high priest convened the Sanhedrin and they stoned James to death. Why? Well, because James was the leader of the New Testament church, as we know from the book of Acts. So he was martyred for his faith in Jesus Christ. Why? Because James, the younger brother of Jesus, saw a resurrection appearance of Jesus, as Paul says, and that brought his conversion. This is one of the most powerful evidences for the resurrection. I mean, most of us have brothers. What would it take to convince you that your brother is the Lord so that you would be ready to die for that belief as James was? Hans Grass, a great New Testament scholar from Germany, has said that one of the greatest proofs of the resurrection of Jesus is the conversion of James, the younger brother of Jesus. Well, then the question is, what's the best explanation of these facts? And I think we saw that Dr. Avalos' own empirical rationalism is overly restrictive. It would deny all sorts of knowledge that we have. Secondly, it's self-refuting. He says you can't use something to refute itself. Sure you can. It's self-referentially incoherent. That is to say, if it's false, it's false. If it's true, it's false. It's like somebody saying, I cannot speak a single word of English. You see, if it's true, it's false. In the same way, his epistemology is simply self-refuting. That's why it's overwhelmingly rejected today. So you cannot restrict rational belief to just verifiable statements and logically demonstrable statements. I would argue that belief in the resurrection of Jesus is what Dr. Avalos calls a reasonable belief. It is inferred on the basis of the evidence. He did not respond to my point that his principle about only appealing to known causes is simply the same as saying hypothesis shouldn't be ad hoc, and I agreed with that, but you can't harden it into a dogmatic presupposition or you inhibit science. And secondly, that we do have independent evidence for the existence of God. So if you believe in God, then you are explaining the resurrection in terms of an entity that you believe or know to exist, namely God. And as a theist who has good reasons to believe in God, I think I'm therefore perfectly rational in believing what the original disciples proclaimed, that
please
God
conclude your remarks.
Raised Jesus from the dead.
Well, again, he's not answering my direct question, and when he did, it's wrong. Because what he just quoted you in Aramaic, it's not from the time of the disciples, which is what he said it would do. I wanted him to show me the Aramaic of the time of the disciples, just like he says that phrase would be. I said that what I would do is to show that what his so-called facts are no such thing, they're not based on substance. This is not the first time Dr. Craig has used bad Aramaic to make arguments. In his book on 1989, it looks very well documented. If you're a student of Campus Crusade for Christ, you'll be impressed. If you're a linguist, you'll be traumatized. Because there, in the space of 8 pages, he gets almost every Aramaic term wrong that he uses to support the resurrection. On page 4, he talks about the Aramaic term for receiving a tradition. And then he makes the case that therefore in 1 Corinthians 15:4, we can trust it, he gets part of that term wrong. Page 4, where he talks about the same thing. He gets that wrong. Page 8, where he talks about the verb for appear in Aramaic, because he wants to make the case that Jesus appeared physically, he gets that wrong. But that doesn't compare to pages 11 to 13, where the word Messiah, the central word, gets it wrong 13 times in Hebrew and Aramaic. Because anybody past the first week in Aramaic would know there's a difference between the kof and the kaf, the hey and the het, the vav and the nun. These are different phonemes. When you use them in the same words, they're going to be wrong, Dr. Craig. And any good Aramaist knows there are no attested examples of first day of the week or any examples expressing days of the week in any biblical Aramaic or in all of Middle Aramaic going by Fitzmyer's chronology, Dr. Craig. So how can you know what the first day of the week would have been in Jesus' time? Number two, there is not enough evidence to say what the Aramaic phrase would have been. What he's quoting you is later. He doesn't tell you that. Indeed, the attested dialects of Aramaic from the first 1,000 years after Jesus have a different construction, and he read it to you in Aramaic, and it's a different construction. Of course, if you don't know Aramaic, you're not going to see that. But let's go back. Let's look at that phrase again. He says that this is what proves that that third century man goes back to the Jesus' time. That phrase, in the first day of the week. Sure, it is awkward in Aramaic. It is abnormal, precisely because, I mean, literally translated, it'd be one in the weeks. The Greek would normally use the word first, the first day of the week, but instead it's using one of the weeks. The second thing that's odd is Sabbath is plural. It's one in the Sabbath to say the first day of the week. That is odd. But does that mean that comes from the language of the disciples? Does that mean we can trace it back to the disciples? No, it doesn't. Why? Because it's in the Greek Bible, Dr. Craig. We know that. Psalm 23:1. You have it there. Taste me as sabbaton. You have the cardinal number one, and you have the plural, Sabbath, sabbaton. So why are you saying it goes back to the disciples' time when it's already in the Greek tradition? We know Mark was using because he quotes from the Greek tradition whenever he quotes the Bible. If you got it from anywhere, it's from the Greek tradition. Any good Aramaic knows that. Why does he say things like that? Acts 27, you see the same phrase there. It's not necessarily early. And let's look at the attested usages. He quoted you from a Targum. And yes, you have it also in Bereshit Rava, commentary on Genesis 11:8. But what he doesn't tell you is it doesn't go back to the time of the disciples. Those are from medieval times. He's using medieval Aramaic to try to get it back to the disciples' time. Now, is that history to you? I'm surprised he didn't look at the Syriac. Because Syriac, you know, translated Mark 16:2 into Syriac. And Syriac is a dialect of Aramaic. What does it have there? Well, what he read to you, he doesn't explain to you that it has a preposition, b'shava. It's literally in one, in the Sabbath. That preposition, b, Dr. Craig, it's not in Mark 16:2. It doesn't have a preposition in there. Why are you saying that would be perfectly good Aramaic when you're quoting Aramaic? It's not from the disciples' time. It's from nearly medieval times. So again, this is a case where lack of knowledge of the primary sources and the languages leads to fallacious facts. What do you call facts for no such thing? There is no such word as first day of the week in the Aramaic of Jesus' time. And he could not quote you a text from that time, as you saw.
Each speaker will now have 5 minutes for closing remarks.
In my closing remarks, I'd like to draw together several of the threads of tonight's debate. We've been debating whether the resurrection of Jesus is a fact or a fiction. I think it's clear tonight we've heard no evidence at all that the resurrection narratives are fictional or false stories. All of the evidence presented tonight has been on one side, that this is a fact. Now, is it in fact credible evidence? Well, I argue tonight that there are four facts that are generally accepted by New Testament historians today: the honorable burial, the empty tomb, the postmortem appearances, and the origin of the disciples' belief in the resurrection. In his last speech, Professor Avalos was reduced to quibbling about linguistic points over Aramaic in an argument that wasn't even part of my case that I presented tonight. But moreover, in fact, he's simply wrong about this. As I said, the Aramaic that would be behind Taimiyat Ton Sabaton is Bechath Beshabutha. This is attested in the second Targum of Esther, chapter 2 and verse 9. The Hebrew Bechath Beshabbat, you have a similar expression in Genesis 8:5, where it refers to on the first day of the month, Bechad Lachodesh. So this is perfectly good Hebrew, perfectly good Aramaic from this time, and that is why, frankly, most scholars today do regard this phrase in Mark as a Semitism, that is to say, as a relic of an earlier Aramaic speaking milieu out of which it came, and that attests to the primitiveness of its tradition. But suppose I'm wrong about that. Suppose that's incorrect. What? So what? It wouldn't affect any of the arguments that I've presented tonight because that wasn't part of my case. Now, Dr. Avalos is right that there are a lot of those Aramaic mistakes in the book of mine that he mentioned. I noticed those to my mortification after the book had appeared in print, and their printer's errors that resulted from inaccurate reading of the Hebrew letters. So he's right, and I hope that this can be corrected in a future edition. Well, what about the best explanation of these four facts, then? Is the best explanation that God raised Jesus from the dead? We've seen that Dr. Avalos' attempt to restrict the best explanation from the resurrection is self-refuting and overly restrictive, that our explanation is not ad hoc, and that his only attempted way to try to explain the resurrection away through hallucinations has three powerful objections against it. And therefore, I think he's been unable to refute my argument that the best explanation of these facts is that God raised Jesus from the dead. But I want to close by saying something about my point at the very beginning of my first speech, that for the majority of Christians, belief in the resurrection is not founded upon historical facts. It's founded upon a personal encounter with the living Lord himself. This is what happened to me. Unlike Dr. Avalos, I was not raised in a Christian home. But as I became a teenager, I began to ask the big questions in life. And in the search for answers, I began to read the New Testament. And I was absolutely captivated, arrested by the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And to make a long story short, after a period of the most intense soul-searching that I've ever gone through, I just simply came to the end of my rope and turned my life over to him. And I experienced a kind of spiritual rebirth in my life, in which God, who had been distant and removed, suddenly became a living reality in my life, a reality that I've walked with now day by day, year by year, for over 30 years. And this is a reality that I believe you too can find if you will seek him with an open heart and an open mind. So if you're seeking to know the truth about the resurrection, there are really two avenues available to you. There is the avenue of historical investigation and research. And if you take that avenue, you will stand well within the mainstream of critical biblical scholarship today. But there is also, more importantly, that personal existential avenue whereby you can come to know the living Lord himself as a personal reality in your life. And I would commend that to you as well. I believe that it can change your life in the same way that it changed mine.
I very much appreciate your applause for me. Thank you. There will be a full postmortem analysis lecture on this debate in the near future, probably on Monday. Contact the ISU Atheist and Agnostic Society. Well, let's go back to what I said I would show. The question was, is there sufficient historical evidence to establish that Jesus resurrected from the dead? My position was, no, there isn't sufficient historical evidence. I said that I would show that some of the main facts on which Dr. Craig bases his belief in the historicity of the resurrection are no such thing. I think I showed that in Mark 16:2. What he said was Aramaic is not, he's still quoting you later text, not telling you. I think I showed it when he said Josephus said James died for his faith in Jesus. Josephus didn't say that. So I think I have proven that what some of the things he calls facts are no such thing. And I think I showed that what Dr. Craig's so-called historical criteria for judging historicity can be used to establish the historicity of events he would otherwise deem to be false or non-historical. That's why he cannot explain to you why he cannot take historically Matthew 27. But he wants you to take historically Mark 16, even though they say the same thing pretty much. They were raised. And let me tell you, I come from the old school of Christian apologetics. One of my heroes was Robert Dick Wilson. Robert Dick Wilson said he would learn any language, acquire any tool in order to check out the evidence. I try to live by that. I try to check out everything that I can when I do my research. And I left the resurrection belief because of specific evidence. Not because of some, emotional ground. No, because I went through and researched systematically the evidence to the greatest depth I could. So, to me, I think that you should be acquainted with the primary sources if you're going to do apologetics. You should be acquainted with the primary languages if you're going to do apologetics. Otherwise, a lot of people just think that, really, this is great scholarship. It isn't. It is smoke and mirrors scholarship. And please, Dr. Craig, for the love of everything, don't use Sherwin-White's claim of two generations for legends to form. He backtracked almost immediately, and his statistical data was one event. But as Ecclesiastes 3:8 says, there's a time for war and time for peace. Let me end with a hopeful, peaceful message. Instead of trying to prove that our favorite sacred stories are better than those of everyone else, why not learn to share your sacred stories with those of others and see in them shared hopes and aspirations? So, Dr. Craig, I thank you for coming to the debate. I hope you don't feel I was too rough on you. I just didn't want to disappoint you when you said you wanted specific challenges.
We will now have a time for the audience to ask questions. The protocol that we're going to use is there's one microphone on each side of the auditorium, and we're going to ask people to line up with those microphones if they wish to ask a question. If we have a large number, we may try to give priority to students. We're also going to try to make sure we have an equal number of questions for each speaker. So I'll go in blocks of two, taking one question for each speaker and then move to the other side of the auditorium. While those of you who may want to ask questions are moving to the microphones, let me also remind you that you received comment cards as you were coming in. If you have any reactions to today's debate, I would encourage you to fill those out and hand those in as you exit. I would also remind you that there are going to be CDs available of this debate if you'd like to reserve one. Those are available for $2 after the debate is over. I would ask you to quiet down again and try to give our full attention to the speakers and to the questioners. So as you are asking your questions, I would remind you to keep them brief. If they get too long, I will cut you off to make sure that there's enough time for other people to ask more questions before our time is up. Go ahead.
I'd first like to thank you for coming, but I'd like to question you on your tactics. I kept tally of the number of logical fallacies you committed, and it was 25, the highlights of which were 4 occurrences of shifting the burden of proof, 3 occurrences of argumentum ad populi, and I'll skip over all the others to get to the highlight. Within 60 seconds of standing at the podium, you committed argumentum ad hominem, the equivalent of a 5-year-old calling names.
Shame on you.
All right.
Shame on
you. Yeah, shame on me. I'm also a professional philosopher as well as a New Testament theologian. I understand logic.
Well, obviously, you have no self-control.
Allow the speaker to answer the question, please.
Shame on you. Fours.
Would the audience please be quiet so the speaker can respond?
I don't think I committed any of these informal logical fallacies. I think all of my arguments are carefully formulated according to the canons of logical inference. I do want to say something, though, about the ad hominem point, because I felt very uncomfortable about opening as I did, but I felt I had to do it in light of what I had seen in this earlier debate by way of preempting that happening in tonight's debate, because in front of an untrained audience of undergraduates, misimpressions can arise, and so that was why I did that. I didn't like doing that, but I felt it was necessary in order that we conduct this debate according to professional rules of etiquette and decorum. But I don't think that was ad hominem, because I wasn't saying that what Dr. Avalos said was false because of anything about him. That's what ad hominem means, is that you say a position is false by attacking the person, and I never suggested anything of that sort. So I think that the charge is not correct.
You tried to...
Your question's been answered.
I don't... Is this microphone on? Yeah.
Who's your question for?
Yes. For Dr. Craig.
Okay, go ahead.
Or Lane. The purpose or the value of any explanation is to reduce the level of confusion and the amount of mystery that the alleged facts seem to entail. However, to invoke the supernatural, whether it be God or miracles or whatever, a supernatural agency in a proposed explanation is to bring infinitely more mystery, infinitely more confusion into the explanation than could possibly have been present in the original facts. So it seems to me that by invoking the supernatural to explain the alleged resurrection, you have brought more mystery into the resurrection than the natural hypotheses that were detailed by Professor Avalos.
All right, that's a good question. When you say that the purpose of explanation is to reduce mystery, I think what that means is to reduce the mystery about that particular item which is to be explained. But it doesn't mean to reduce sort of the overall mystery. Indeed, in invoking a new explanation, you might create new mysteries that then opens up new questions. And great examples of this would be quantum theory in physics. In order to explain certain sorts of experimental results, we need to invoke things like quantum indeterminacy, quarks, maybe strings, all sorts of high-level theoretical entities in physics, which, as any quantum physicist will tell you, invoke levels of mystery that just boggle the mind. Nevertheless, you have good reason for believing in these posited entities as the causes or explanations of the particular phenomenon in question. So I would agree with you. Positing the existence of God raises all kinds of different interesting questions that I, as a philosopher, am extremely interested in, but that doesn't do anything to suggest that this is not the best explanation of the facts of the empty tomb, the origin of the Christian faith, and the resurrection appearances. When I compare it to these other naturalistic explanations, I find that they all are deficient in their explanatory power, explanatory scope, plausibility, and other objective criteria that one uses to determine the best explanation.
Could I have the next person in line here with a question for Dr. Avalos?
Yeah, that's me.
Go.
I think the actual question here tonight was, is the Christian faith fact or fiction? Now, as a Christian, we believe in God. If we believe in God, we believe in the Word of God. If we believe in the Word of God, then we believe in the resurrection. Now, you don't believe in God, so you don't believe in the Word of God, so you don't believe in the resurrection. So what is the point of life?
Please be quiet so the speaker can answer the question.
The point of life is to live as healthy as possible in healthy relationships. To me, the basis of all life is good relationships, fellow human beings, wife, kids, whatever. That's the point of life.
Could I have the next questioner from this side?
I have a question for Dr. Craig. First of all, let me thank you for your wonderful exposition. I thought it was very well argued. I myself am a Jew, and I have no problem with mystery. I do have a great deal of problem with biblical literalism, like this young lady who calls the Bible the Word of God. This, to me as a Jew, is idolatry, because only God is God, not a book. We are surrounded by biblical literalists. Obviously, Dr. Craig, you are not one, because you don't take everything. You believe certain things are legendary. Probably I would imagine, the myth of the creation of the world in 6 days, I would imagine you think is a myth, as I do. However, my question is this. As you realize, the Gospel of Mark, according to most New Testament scholars, is the only one that was actually written before the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., The oldest editions of the Gospel of Mark do not include descriptions of the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus, but end with the women coming to the empty tomb. They see it, and a young man is there, not an angel, a young man is there who tells them, "Why do you seek the living among the dead? He goes before you into Galilee. Go therefore, telling the disciples that he is risen," something like that, I believe. And the gospel ends that they run away and they say nothing to anyone. The end. Then there are later additions that come along. I want to also point out that there are, along with this mystery of the empty tomb, we also have a very mysterious thing in the post-resurrection appearances described by Matthew, John, and Mark, the writers of those Gospels. John, they all share this in common. The people do not recognize Jesus. Mary Magdalene, according to the Gospel of John, in the garden, mistakes Jesus for the gardener and talks to him at quite length before she realizes that it is Jesus himself. The disciples who walk with Jesus on the road to Emmaus the day or two after the supposed resurrection, they also do not recognize Jesus, but think of him as a stranger on the road. They do not recognize him all day.
Did you sum up your question?
Please. May I proceed?
Yes, please sum up.
There are three resurrection stories that I wanted to ask you about. The second, they also do not recognize him until they invite him to dinner several hours later. He breaks the bread, and then they recognize him as Jesus, and he disappears magically. The third one I want to talk about, I'm not sure if it's Matthew or Luke, but the disciples are fishing, and again they see a mysterious stranger upon the shore whom they do not recognize. And then only when he says, "Dip your nets into the water and come up with a full load of fish," do they recognize him as Jesus. How do you understand these mysterious misrecognitions of Jesus if he's truly physically and bodily resurrected? Are you sure they're not just strangers that they perhaps imagine to be the resurrected Lord? Or perhaps even that every man is Jesus, is Christ, is the incarnation of God, perhaps?
Yeah. With respect to Mark 16, scholars dispute whether or not the original gospel actually ended at verse 8 or not, or whether there might be a lost ending that would include resurrection appearances as well. But clearly, in any case, Mark has foreshadowed resurrection appearances in Galilee. He has the angel say to the women, "Tell Peter and his disciples, he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him as he told you." So even if Mark doesn't choose to narrate the appearances in Galilee, he knows of them, and he foreshadows them in his gospel. Now, this non-recognition motif that you mentioned is very mysterious. I agree with you. I've often wondered, what is going on here? We shouldn't exaggerate the extent of this. As you say, it only appears in three of the resurrection stories, this non-recognition motif. And I don't think that the most plausible explanation is to say, "Oh, well, it was just strangers," or something like that, because
What that does is takes the stories to be literally historically credible enough to believe in the non-recognition motif, but then doesn't take it credible enough to believe in the other supernatural aspects of the narrative. And you can't play this kind of arbitrary pick and choose with the narratives. So I think what's going on there is some kind of a theological point that the evangelists are trying to make. And my suggestion, though I'm not sure about this, could be this, is that it's a way of saying to the disciples that Jesus is not continuing with them in the same mode of existence in the same manner that they once knew him when he walked with them in Galilee. That now, as the risen and glorified Lord, they will relate to Jesus in a new way that isn't going to be that similar, familiar, earthly sort of encounter that they used to have with him, and that this non-recognition motif and the disclosure of Jesus, for example, in the breaking of the bread in Emmaus or in the miraculous catch of fish on the Sea of Tiberias, is a way of saying that Jesus in his risen and exalted mode of existence will relate to the disciples in a new way. That's the best I can do with that.
Do you believe in evolution?
We need to go to the next questioner, please. Who has the next question for Dr. Avalos? You've already had a lengthy question, sir. We're ready for the next questioner. Is there another questioner for Dr. Avalos on this side?
Yes. Dr. Avalos, you based your whole argument, or most of it, the vast majority on it, on discrediting Dr. Craig instead of discrediting the resurrection of Jesus, which is what we all came here to hear you do. So I think in order to like redeem yourself, could you just like give a few explanations, alternative explanations to the resurrection of Jesus and why they're better than Dr. Craig's? And you really don't have to mention Dr. Craig to do that.
Please be quiet so Dr. Avalos can answer the question.
If you phrase that question respectfully, I will answer it.
Okay, do we have the next question from this side?
Mine's for Dr. Craig. I found it kind of interesting that you didn't attempt to refute Dr. Avalos' point that we didn't have any documents, any real documents prior to the 3rd century concerning the resurrection. So my question to you is, do we have any actual documents from that could have been written by anyone who knew Jesus?
Well, we have copies of those documents, but no, we don't have the original autographs. But please, I want to say to you, in all sincerity, this isn't where the debate lies. I did respond to that point. Textual critics have thousands of Greek manuscripts, and they come in different families so that they're not all just copied from the same original. They, in the sense that there is an Alexandrian text, a Byzantine text, a Caesarean text, a Western text. And by comparing these with each other, textual scholars are able to reconstruct the text of the New Testament with over 99% accuracy. So please, I mean, if you want to, you know, argue about the resurrection and so forth, that's fine. But let's keep the argument where the real dispute is. The text of the New Testament isn't in serious dispute today, even by the most skeptical critics. Otherwise, you would have to explain to me, where are the textual variants for the resurrection narratives? I mean, apart from the lost ending of Mark, I mean, what are you talking about here in terms of textual corruption? The text of the New Testament is substantially the same as it was originally written, and so you don't need to worry about the fact that this may have been corrupted over the centuries. The manuscripts that we have are so early and so many that the text can be reconstructed with 99% confidence of what the original autographs, the original documents really said.
So you don't dispute the dates at all?
Right. We need to go to the next questioner. Who has the next question for Dr. Avalos? Go ahead.
Dr. Avalos, Dr. Craig pointed out that if one does not believe miracles are even possible, then he or she can only interpret the biblical documents as being made up, that just immediately follows. And then he pointed out how your empirical rationalistic epistemology or theory of knowledge, basically your worldview through which you interpret everything, including the biblical documents, does not allow for the possibility of knowledge in any other way. He pointed out how empirical rationalism is self-defeating. You would say it's self-affirming, but it affirms that it's self-defeating. You never really dealt with his point that you can use rationality, reason, to point out bad reason, just like you can use good logic to point out bad logic. You never really responded to that. Do you have anything to kind of follow up on
that? Well, I thought I did very well
in
that his rationale could not distinguish between the historicity of Matthew 27, 52, and 53 from the historicity of Mark 16. So how is his rationale helping you establish history? Secondly, I don't think you can defeat empirical rationalism with empirical rationalism.
That statement doesn't make sense.
Well, by using logic, you're using rationalism. By pointing to facts, you're using empiricism. So you're affirming the very thing you're trying to deny. You can't do it. You have to use something else to defeat empirical rationalism. And the third point is, I was trying to show Dr. Craig is a naturalist. He's just a relativistic naturalist because he applies naturalism to stories he does not favor. He a priori would exclude because of his theology. For example, any claims made by any other god, he doesn't believe in other gods. So he couldn't possibly take seriously the historical claims made on behalf of other gods. So he's a priori excluding other things. He's a priori excluding apocalypticism sometimes from historicity. There's all kinds of exclusions going on his side.
Okay, could we have the next questioner from this side?
Yes, my question is based on why there was a burden of proof on Dr. Avalos. We've seen throughout history that when a person dies and you dig up the body, there are bones there. If I die in 50 years, my bones will be there. It's the wild claim, and I mean no disrespect in saying that, of course. It's the claim that goes against the norm that generally needs a burden of proof. Why does Dr. Avalos need to prove that things happen normally as they always have since and did before versus you proving that things happen supernaturally?
Yeah. Well, you've offered an argument. I mean, and that was more than he did. That's a good argument to raise. You're saying the laws of nature exclude this, and so it must be false. And then we would have to argue about that. What I said was that the belief that God raised Jesus from the dead doesn't contradict science. It doesn't contradict any natural law, because those only describe what happens naturally. And I agree that it's naturally impossible for people to rise again from the dead. I wholeheartedly endorse that. But what I suggest is that the hypothesis God raised Jesus from the dead is not unacceptably ad hoc, and I do have independent reasons for believing that God exists, so I have these explanatory resources in my worldview, and so I think it's legitimate to appeal to them. Let me say as well, too, that your argument wouldn't do anything to dispute the facts of the case, things like the burial, the empty tomb, the postmortem appearances. Those are just historical facts. What your argument would be against would be the best explanation for them. You would concede the facts, but just say you can never adopt a supernatural explanation. But I think that's an arbitrary restriction. It's an attempt to say that the pool of live options for an explanation is going to be limited to naturalistic explanations. And if you do that, well, then I'll agree with you that some naturalistic explanation is the best explanation that's naturalistic. But that's not the question. We want to know what is the best explanation overall, including in the pool of live options, a possible supernatural explanation. Dr. Avalos has said he's willing to let that be in the pool of live options. His objection wasn't like yours. He was saying
that we can't infer the resurrection because we can only appeal to known causes. But I gave counterexamples to that, tried to explain how that would impede science, and then also that I do have grounds for thinking that I do know God exists. So that's why I think it's legitimate to infer in this case the resurrection.
Could I have the next question for Dr. Avalos?
First of all, I'd like to thank you both for being here. Thanks for a great debate. And Dr. Avalos, you never directly refuted any of the facts that Dr. Craig stated in his first the opening statements. So my question to you is, do you have any direct refutation of any of that? I know you tried to prove that Dr. Craig was, he has in the past told stuff that wasn't true, which he gave reasons for. Is there any reason that we shouldn't believe anything that he said tonight? Do you have any direct refutation of anything that he said? Thanks.
I think Dr. Craig is just playing a semantic game. He wants to pretend that just calling something a fact makes it a fact. So he starts with the fact of postmortem appearances. That's not a fact. We can't verify postmortem appearances happened. All we have is a story of postmortem appearances. What makes that story a fact? Well, he uses a lot of this argument, as the probably the earlier questioner pointed out, this argumentum ad verecundiam, which means he uses an appeal to authority. Most scholars agree. Well, listen, what group of scholars are you quoting? Mostly Christian scholars. What do you think most Christian scholars are going to say? They're already committed to the resurrection. Does he do that with Muslim scholars? Does he say, most Muslim scholars agree that the Quran is a revelation of God? Therefore, I'm going to start with that. You see, he's doing a lot of this stuff that you're not going to notice until you dissect it very, very carefully. And, for example, 99% of texts, we have 99% reliability of the New Testament. Nonsense. We don't have the autographs. How could you possibly come up with that statistic? You can only come up with that statistic if you compare the manuscripts to the original. You don't have the original, so how would you know it's 99% like the original if you don't have the original? It's nonsense.
Oh my. Could I have the next question from this side, please?
It's for Dr. Avalos. If you don't believe in any supernatural essences to this this world at all, then how do you account for many miracles in Jesus's and all the disciples' time and times hereafter that are pretty recent, too?
You're still confusing the event with stories about the events. I don't grant you that there were miracles. I only grant you that there are stories of miracles. And if you did that, if you did history that way, why don't you believe in Marian apparitions? Dr. Craig says, well, everybody knows that people don't rise naturally from the dead. Well, there must be a supernatural explanation. Well, why don't you do that with Marian apparitions? People know that Mary couldn't possibly rise naturally from the dead. So why don't you just say, Dr. Craig, those appearances must be true. Mary must be alive, since witnesses are experiencing something. And by the way, another famous trick is, the disciples couldn't possibly have a pre-existing tradition. Every tradition, the first instance, doesn't have a pre-existing tradition. That's another bogus argument. If you do that, every tradition would not have a pre-existing tradition. Wouldn't be in the mind before the first instance of it.
Okay, we have time for one more question for Dr. Craig. This side. Anyone? Is there a question for Dr. Craig from this side?
I wish to speak a moment, please. I have a driver's license here. My name is Jesus Christ. I am a scientist. I study electromagnetic phenomena. I study paramagnetic phenomena, ferromagnetic phenomena, and dielectric phenomena. I think these three phenomena is what God uses to take the center of the Earth, which I think has a density of 10,000 grams per cubic centimeter, which is the density of the neutron, the proton, the electron, and all subatomic particles, to make the molecules of the bodies of which we live. I think that it is time for us to take a good look at what we're doing tonight. I like it. I like when people discuss and talk, and it doesn't mean that we all have the same ideas. It means that through this discussion, we're going to come to a conclusion, a little bit better setting for the days ahead. Now, here's what my question to both of these men are. What is the density of the center of the Earth?
I don't know.
Well, perhaps ending with an unanswerable question is a perfect segue into asking all of you to think carefully about the unanswered questions you have from this evening. And I hope you will really think through the arguments you've heard on both sides and join me in thanking both participants for a very stimulating debate.